for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Secretary Kerry proposes a week-long ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. President Obama meets with Central American presidents today on child migrants. And the bodies of the downed Malaysian jet arrive in the Netherlands. Here for the week's top stories on the International News Roundup, Michael Hirsch of Politico, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and James Kitfield of Atlantic Media's Defense One and the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. And throughout the hour, you are invited, as always, to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Happy Friday to all of you.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Good to see you. I wonder, James Kitfield, about what's going on, the latest situation in Gaza. There are still competing arguments over who hit this UN school and killed 15 people.
Right. I mean, you have very close-in urban fighting. It's why these, periodic fights between Israel and the Hamas and Gaza are always so deadly, densely packed places. I mean, these UN schools are places where the Israelis tell people to flee to, so you would have thought they'd be on the Israeli map as a place to avoid fire. We're not exactly sure what happened. The Israelis are speculating maybe it was mortars fired by Hamas. We really don't know yet, but clearly this horrific carnage is causing a huge international pressure to reach some sort of a ceasefire. I expect that will happen. It always does happen at some point when Hamas has gained enough attention and Israel has gained enough condemnation for, all the civilian death toll. The question is, have we reached that limit where it's become difficult for Israel to keep this up? We need to find a ceasefire, and Secretary Kerry is in the region trying very hard to reach that.
And the Israeli cabinet's meeting now. Apparently, two ministers walked out of that meeting saying they were against any kind of truce. They want to continue going after Hamas. Nancy.
Yes, and that's an interesting development because one of the things we saw this week was the start of the ground offensive, and there were a lot of surprises in it. I think there was an expectation among some that Hamas would not be able to sustain the ground offensive. The fact that 33 Israeli soldiers were killed, one has been captured and feared dead, three civilians killed, these are numbers that far surpass the death toll on the Israeli military side from 2006, and it took the Israeli military years to recover from the trauma of that war, and that rather than calming tensions and calming both sides are really digging in their heels more and more with each passing day. New York Times is reporting that Secretary Kerry, who earlier this week was very ambitious about a wide peace plan, is now looking for something much more limited, just a suspension of the violence. And as you say, an Israeli cabinet or parliament that isn't eager to bring peace talks, but to use the digging in their heels even more and saying this is the opportunity to crush Hamas, that these tentative peace deals of 2012 and in the past, that there's not an appetite to repeat that, but rather to use this as an opportunity to crush what I think many think is a weakened Hamas.
A weakened Hamas, Michael Hirsch?
That was the perception, and Hamas well knew it. And that's one of the reasons why, Diane, I think the stakes in this conflict are higher for both sides than they have been in memory. Everything Nancy said is exactly right. The casualty levels for the Israelis are higher than they were back in 2006. In the wake of the failure of the peace talks, there has been a growing sense among Israelis that the two-state solution is all but gone. Meanwhile, Hamas is desperate to recapture its stature, when it first took over Gaza in 2006. And I think that because those lines have been so sharply drawn between both sides, you're not going to see an end to this conflict, despite John Kerry's presence there right now in trying to negotiate this week-long ceasefire.
You know, I'm a little more hopeful than that, because I think at this point, Hamas has made its point, and I think that it does have. Hamas has one major problem, which is in the past it could support, count on the support of Egypt to a certain degree when the Muslim Brotherhood Prime Minister Morsi was there. Right now, it's being squeezed from the Egyptian side, who has destroyed a lot of their tunnels. Now the Israelis have destroyed a lot of their tunnels going into Israel. So at some point, Hamas is going to be want to put an end to this, but I don't expect they'll get all their demands, that there's prerequisites for a ceasefire, but I don't imagine this going on for weeks.
Well, the question I think becomes, will they get the end of the economic blockade in some form? And Egypt plays a very key role in this, and the fact that they've been unwilling to open the Rafah border crossing, which goes from the Sinai into Gaza. And so the question becomes, who's going to give? And Egypt has no incentive to do that. Egypt has equated Hamas with the Muslim Brotherhood as part of their war on terror. The United States is reaching out to Qatar and Turkey, but how much influence can they have in terms of creating the end of an economic blockade remains unclear. And so you're right that these things have always ended in some sort of negotiation, but it's how that happens in this climate where both sides feel that they either have a right or are winning. Hamas feels that it is winning the war of international perception. Perhaps we don't feel it in this country, but throughout Europe, they get that sense. And Israel believes that this is an opportunity to finally crush a threat.
What about the death toll on the Palestinian side, Nancy?
Yes, today we crossed 800. It's a remarkable number. The United Nations estimates that 75% of those were civilians. Israelis have said that they've killed 500 militants. They are breathtaking numbers, and the stories and the photos that have come out this week are just devastating.
Yeah, and again, even though I don't disagree with James's assessment of the relative weakness of Hamas, I think the motivations are high. They do know that large parts of Europe are with them. There are protests in the West Bank, which is controlled by Fatah, where protesters are bearing Hamas flags, which is quite remarkable given the acrimony between Hamas and Fatah. And a sense that, this is it for them. One of the most remarkable things that's happened in the last few days is the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, uncovering of these intricate tunnels that Hamas has used. Some of these have been stocked with tranquilizers, presumably to use against kidnapped Israelis. So Hamas's basic infrastructure is being uncovered now, and the Israelis show every sign they're not going to stop there, which means that Hamas can't stop itself.
But let's talk about what Hamas and Abbas are asking for in the way of changes to Gaza.
Well, and we should point out the fact that Abbas, who runs the, more secular and moderate, Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, reached a unity government with Hamas, and because he was so frustrated by the failure of the peace talks that he
but
thought...
But that's who Kerry's been talking to, is Abbas.
Exactly, because he's the moderate. So the problem with this cycle of conflict, and we tell this to our Israeli friends all the time, is that, you have to take advantage of the interludes between these violent conflicts to reach a peace deal, because all these conflicts continually empower the extremists on both sides, both in the Israeli body politic and also on the Palestinian side. So once again, as we talked about, Hamas thinks it's being empowered, while Abbas looks like a stooge of the Israelis. He's got protests on the West Bank. He can't reach a deal through a peaceful means with Israel. Just had 9 months of peace talks, come to a spectacular failure conclusion recently. So it's that lack of hope. So, and believe me, once this is over, and Martin Indyk said this recently, I think on NPR, is that, you'll have to get back to the strategic problem is that there are grievances on both sides, and you have to address those, because if you keep going in this cycle of violence, slowly but surely, everyone loses hope, and the extremists are empowered, and you're talking about perpetual conflict.
one of the things that I'm watching for in the next few days is the death toll on both sides. That is, how much will the Israelis be willing to sustain the ongoing deaths of their troops, another one today. And on the Palestinian side, will the residents of Gaza start to lash out, as we've started to see early indications of, on Hamas because of the risk that they're being put under? When you have something like a UN shelter bombed and 15 people killed, where are they supposed to go? And you can start to feel the resentment on the streets from the people within Gaza toward Hamas. So I think those are both indicators. And also, if there is increased violence in the West Bank, because that would mean Israel would essentially face a two-front conflict, one in the West Bank and one in Gaza, and that would put a kind of pressure on it. So those, in my estimation, are the metrics that we look for in the next few days to see if we're closer or further away from some sort of ceasefire.
Now, Secretary Kerry, in his typical quixotic manner, is trying to use these negotiations over a ceasefire to resurrect the peace talks that failed. But I think that he's got it sort of get a grip on reality, if you will, and address what I hear from many Israelis who are expert in the peace negotiations, which is that you cannot expect final settlement of the biggest issues. You got to reach an interim agreement. In Benjamin Netanyahu, you have a prime minister who clearly is not willing to engage on these final settlement issues. So what they need to do is completely reorient what they tried to do over the past year, which was address those issues, Jerusalem, right of return, and come to some sort of an interim deal that will not only implement a ceasefire, but will at least start to make progress towards some sort of a two-state settlement. Because the two-state concept, which many Israelis themselves believe is crucial, is all but gone with the wind right now.
Michael Hirsch, he's national editor at Politico. And we'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Ukraine. Take your calls. I look forward to speaking with you. And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with James Kitfield. He's contributing editor at National Journal and Atlantic Media's Defense One and the National Interest. He's senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and the Congress. Nancy Youssef is national security correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Michael Hirsch is national editor at Politico. On the Israeli subject, here's an email from Larry. He says, do not forget that according to Haaretz, the Kerry proposal allows Israel to pursue its military objectives, destroy the tunnels and whatever, but stops any Hamas resistance. No guarantees of removing the blockade, just negotiation. Why wouldn't Hamas jump at this opportunity?
Because it doesn't deal with the economic issues. Remember, to give you a sense, in Gaza, young men, the unemployment rate is about 46%. Things like fishing are banned. The border crossing, I've been to it, and it is a scene of constant suffering is the only way I can describe it. During peaceful times, and remember, it's been closed under the Sisi government in Egypt for most of the past year, and so Hamas has sort of raised expectations, if you will, among some, and saying that we're winning the campaign of public perception. We're defending against an Israel that has limited your ability to live. So how can they, at this point, come forward and say, we'll accept a peace deal that doesn't change your economic standing at all after all the suffering that has happened around you for the past 17 days?
I don't believe the Kerry plan says that Israel can stay engaged inside Gaza and continue to I mean, that is a non-starter, obviously, for obvious reasons. He wants a ceasefire that gets the Israeli forces out of Gaza, but also stops the rockets, because Israel can't be seen to backing down while rockets are raining down on the cities. So that, to me, is the deal. You know, whether the blockade will be lifted or not, it will not be lifted as far as a ceasefire, because Israel cannot be seen as giving in to major concessions under fire from a terrorist group that is a stated terrorist group from us.
So what do you have to do to get those rockets to stop firing?
Well, Diane, I mean, the sad fact is the Israelis believe that they have to effectively destroy Hamas, which is another reason why I don't think this ends. I mean, one of the real dangers here is that even as anti-Israel sentiment grows internationally, there is even a sort of a divestment movement that the Palestinians have started up, which is starting to gain traction, and the Israelis should be worried about it. That is effectively turning into, you know, Israel into what South Africa was in the 1980s, and perceived as an anti-apartheid state against which colleges and other major pension funds are divesting. Even as that's happening on the ground in Israel, public opinion is shifting toward a harder line. You have Naftali Bennett, a far-right member of Netanyahu's coalition, calling for effectively a military-type occupation, a security zone in the West Bank. Meanwhile, obviously, Palestinians, formerly moderates, are agitating in the West Bank. So you have the real potential here for a wider war if Kerry fails.
And what about the halt in U.S. Airlines landing in Israel, James? How much does that hurt?
Oh, that hurts Israel a great deal. I mean, they stake their reputation and their brand as being this one sort of pocket of stability and technological advancement and economic opportunity in
the
Middle East.
So why did the U.S. do that?
Well, I mean, on the face of it, the FAA doesn't look at the politics of this. It looks at the risk factors. And a rocket did land within a couple of kilometers of the airport. And with the recent shoot down of the Malaysian 17 over Ukraine, they're very scared about, you know, civilian air traffic into conflict zones. So, you know, the Israelis immediately thought, well, maybe they're trying to put pressure on us by cutting down, because once we did it, of course, the Europeans followed suit. So were we trying to pressure them? You know, I don't know the answer to that. I would be somewhat surprised if that was the case, because that kind of thing tends to come out, and it would really sour U.S.-Israeli relations.
It would be a first step, Nancy.
It would be a first step. And as James says, Israel was not happy with it. John Kerry was on a plane from Cairo to Jerusalem within hours of that announcement because of the perception that it gave that, you know, Israel's always said, for whatever is going on, this is a safe place to live. And the defiance that was happening even within this country, Michael Bloomberg taking an LL flight, the Israeli airline in the middle of that embargo on travel, was certainly a sign of the divisions within this country about the decision. It was an interesting development in that it suggested, if you believe that it was a form of pressure, the variety of options needed, given that the dynamics of the Middle East have changed so much, that the players that would have been involved, Egypt primarily, is no longer there, and that everybody's looking at sort of alternative and creative and unheard of, really, approaches at trying to push sides into agreeing to a ceasefire, if you believe it was a strategic move.
In some ways, it marked Hamas's greatest victory in memory. And we shouldn't speak of it in the past tense, because even though the FAA has lifted its ban, Not all airlines have resumed their flights into Tel Aviv, and we don't know when that's going to happen. We don't know whether political pressure on the part of protesting publics in Europe, for example, might be part of that. We are also not quite sure why the FAA lifted its ban. The Israelis say that they reassured FAA that this was the most protected air zone in the world, which in some respects Israel is. On the other hand, there was a lot of political pressure from Senator Ted Cruz and others on Capitol Hill to lift the ban. So we don't really know why it happened, and it's not really an issue that's quite over yet. We have to see airlines resume.
Here's an email from Chris who says, I know two of the soldiers killed in Israel were Americans. Is Israel the only country where Americans can enlist? I can't recall Americans joining other foreign countries' armies.
You know, I was kind of struck by that story because it's not only Americans, but apparently thousands of sort of foreigners have come to Israel. I guess, you know, if you're, because it's a Jewish state and if you're Jewish around the world, you might feel like when it's under attack, it's your responsibility to come help. But I'm not aware that Americans are part of other foreign military forces. It's an interesting question. I've never really run that to ground.
Right. Let's turn to the Ukraine and the latest on the Malaysian airliner. Nancy, do we know with certainty who fired the missile that downed the plane?
We do not. And it's sort of remarkable in terms of how little is known at this point. There are suggestions that separatists using Russian equipment, potentially trained by Russians, shot down this plane. It hasn't been confirmed. And it's a very delicate thing once that confirmation happens because it demands a lot from the international community in terms of how one responds to Russia. Does the international community put more international sanctions on Russia and how Putin himself, Vladimir Putin himself, will respond to that. And so it's been very carefully approached in terms of the language that people use in terms of what is known and what isn't known. What we saw instead was a beautiful and solemn ceremony in the Netherlands as the victims were brought back, and that was such an important thing for not only the 193 of the 298 who were Dutch and killed on that flight, but also for Malaysians, many of them who are Muslim and who saw the bodies lying on the ground, a violation of Islamic practices, which demand an immediate burial.
There is no definitive evidence yet, but most of the witness testimony, most of the evidence accumulated, which I think will be added to once the data from the black boxes is examined and analyzed, indicating whether the pilots saw a missile contrail headed their way. In addition to which, we know that the very sophisticated Russian SA-11, SA-12 missile systems that were in the hands of the separatists, either because they overran a Ukrainian military base or because they were supplied by the Russians, were the most likely suspect here, the only type of missile system, Doppler-guided, that could reach that height, say 33,000 feet. So there's nothing conclusive yet. Russian propaganda continues to say that this was shot down by the Ukrainian Air Force, but the indications are overwhelming that this was a missile launched by the separatists.
And here's what Phil in Indianapolis says. To what extent are Americans the victims of propaganda very much as the Russians are? He says, I'm told rebels in Ukraine thought they were firing on a Ukrainian bomber, and the Ukrainian government had been frequently bombing cities in eastern Ukraine. Was the shooting down of MH17 a defensive response to repeated Ukrainian Air Force aggression? I've heard virtually nothing about this in American media. What's true, Jim?
So, I'm a little bit disagreement. I mean, I think we know what happened. I just don't think that we've got the person raising his hand saying, yes, I did it. But other than that, we tracked the radar coming from rebel-controlled territory of a missile going towards that aircraft. We saw that aircraft disappear from radar. We heard the rebels brag about it on social media and then quickly realized it was civilian, took that down from social media. We've intercepted communications between commanders of saying that they did that and what to do in the aftermath, and they realized. So we pretty much know what happened.
What about the black boxes?
I think the black boxes will tell us very little because it'll be an abrupt stop. I don't think they'll see that contrail coming because, you know, pilots tend to look straight ahead. There's a missile coming up. It's not something I believe that they will see coming. We'll wait and see. But I'll be very surprised if the black boxes dispute any of the narrative I just said. Now, on the question of did they think it was a military plane? Yes, they did. They said that also and then intercepted. They were very proud of it. They have shot down, I think, 6 or 8 helicopters, a military transport. Yesterday shot down 2 military aircraft. They have very sophisticated surface-to-air missiles, and they're using them with great effect, which makes you wonder whether they get either trained or there are Russians who are actually operating this stuff because they're being very effective. So to me, it's not a great mystery what happened. What worries me is that after all this international condemnation, Russia is, according to U.S. intelligence, poised to pour more heavy weaponry into that part of eastern Ukraine. So Russia has not taken this as a lesson to stop supporting the rebels. And to the last point of the listener, yes, they are being bombed by the Ukrainian government. I mean, the Ukrainian government is still the authority that is in charge of Ukraine. And these separatists who have basically claimed, independent regions of Ukraine are, by international law, not a legal entity. So they're trying to reclaim their territory.
Yeah, I mean, it was done in defense. You can certainly say that. What remains, I think, really at issue here is the role of Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. How careless was he, irresponsible, to allow such sophisticated systems to fall into the hands of these rather poorly organized separatists that clearly his government has been fostering, whether it was because they were supplied and urged to overrun the Ukrainian military bases in Donetsk, or whether they actually directly got supplied with it. You know, this is a question for Putin.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nancy.
Well, one of the interesting developments that James had mentioned was that the United States said yesterday that Russians are shooting artillery from inside Russia into Ukraine, that they're sending heavier rocket launchers than were there before. And the presumption is that the reason that they're doing it is because the Ukrainians will not fire at Russia. So this becomes a way to defend the separatists in a way that the Ukrainians cannot respond to. And so it was interesting that the United States, it came out at a State Department briefing, which was somewhat surprising. And it seems that the United States is trying to put international pressure by shining a spotlight on the degree and the intensity with which the Russians are getting involved, so much so that they're firing from within their borders.
So what about tougher sanctions? Is the EU going to join the U.S.?
I mean, that is the $64 million question. If they won't do it now, you would have to wonder if they will ever do it. And quite honestly, the West looks extremely weak right now. The Dutch, obviously, having lost almost 200 of its citizens, are taking a hard line. So is the United Kingdom. But there is heavy resistance amongst certainly Germany, which has a huge trade relationship with Russia, and some of those really weak economies that were sort of upended by the financial crisis that don't feel that now's the time to sort of roil the economic trade with Russia. But
and dependent on all that fuel oil coming.
Correct,
through.
Correct. So for various reasons, and if you're Putin and you're reading this, I mean, there's no other conclusion you can draw except for I can get away with this because the West is very weak, they're not going to put in meaningful sanctions.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem is that the EU is 28 nations and we, the United States, are one. So, you know, we can decide a lot easier than they do. And each of these countries, France, Germany, UK, has different types of trade relationships. The UK has a very big financial interest. France has, I think it was a $1.6 billion contract to deliver aircraft to Russia. Germany has an enormous fuel dependence on Russia. So you have a lot of reluctance based on that. I will say, though, however, in the last day or so, After a week of waffling, there has been a decision taken by the EU, which still needs to be approved, to sanction an additional 15 Russians. So they are finally stepping up, it appears. And what you're seeing is Vladimir Putin is becoming more and more isolated here, even as he stepped up his own efforts.
What about Ukraine's prime minister resigning yesterday? Was this a surprise, Nancy?
Not really. I know it looks like it was in the middle of all this that it was a surprise, but it was rather expected, given that the sort of transitional sort of period that Ukraine was in. So it was, I had, when I'd heard it, thought maybe this was tied to the violence and whatnot. And it doesn't appear to be that. This was rather expected. And it comes at a time when Ukrainians are divided about whether their military is doing better or worse at fending off the aggression from separatists.
Of course, the country is on the verge of financial collapse.
Right, it's in very difficult shape. But, you know, the head of state there is the prime minister, Poroshenko, and he basically approved this resignation and apparently sets up some elections in the fall. I think that they want to sort of send the message that they're in a transformational period. And my reading was the same as Nancy's. It was not really as closely tied to the violence as it first looked.
James Kitfield, Nancy Youssef, Michael Hirsch. They're all here to answer your questions after we take a short break. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Lumosity.com. Personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through games. Lumosity.com. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at Hewlett.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor. Honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, as Project Runway begins its new season, we feature our interview with Tim Gunn. Although he's now a confident mentor, he had a difficult adolescence. He stuttered, he was in denial about being gay, and he was bullied. When he was 17, he tried to kill himself. We'll talk about his life and, of course, about fashion. Join us.
Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Nancy Youssef and James Kitfield and Michael Hirsch. Here's the first email question. Where are the Hamas rockets made? Eric in Charlotte, North Carolina, wants to know.
The sophisticated rockets, and each time we've had these fights between Israel and Gaza, the rockets get more sophisticated, and they come from Iran. And that's why, you know, Iran has been so helpful to Assad in Syria in his fight against his own civil rebels, because the conduit to Hamas was through Syria and Damascus, and then from there to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and then passed from there to Hamas. They've captured any number of ships over the years with loads of these Iranian rockets bound for Hamas. So we know where their sophisticated rockets come from, and it's Tehran.
Let's go to Marjorie in Hollis, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I believe our Congress's bias towards Israel is actually hurting the peace talks. For example, 2006, Israel attacked Lebanon, killed over 1,300 people, totally devastated the Lebanon infrastructure. At that time, Iraqis had elected al-Maliki. Maliki criticized Israel for the bombing of Lebanon. He said it was overkill. Well, our Congress was outraged. I remember Maliki was scheduled to visit Washington, and our Congress said that they would not meet with him. So our soldiers are fighting and dying in Iraq to bring them democracy. Well, the newly elected leader dares to criticize Israel. Congress attacks him.
All right. Thanks for your call.
The listener is correct that Israel has a very, very strong support in Congress in a way that no Arab Muslim country has, but particularly not Iraq. That's been true for a very long time for all kinds of historic reasons for it, but it's undeniable.
All right. Let's talk for a moment about Nigeria and Boko Haram. A report on the NewsHour the other night suggested that Boko Haram's power and strength is spreading throughout much farther than we have perceived it in the past, Nancy.
That's right. There were two attacks, explosives, this past Wednesday, in the northern city of Kaduna, an area that was presumed to be sort of out of the immediate grasp of Boko Haram. They had targeted a moderate sheikh, who didn't sort of prescribe to their brand of Islam. They targeted the runner-up in the 2011 presidential election and killed 75 people. And one of the things that it sort of showcases, in a sense, their effort to stretch the Nigerian military, that rather than just sort of focusing on the northeast and the areas that they were presumed to target, that these attacks forced the Nigerian military to stretch their resources across the country. The President Goodluck Jonathan asked for an additional $1 billion, was essentially snubbed for that money, but came on the heels of this attack. And it comes at a time where this week we entered the 100-day mark of the 200-plus girls who were taken, whose capture sparked an international campaign, and they remain missing despite this international pressure. And so these attacks, plus the ongoing detention of those girls, really capture the breadth and the scope of Boko Haram's grip on Nigeria.
No, exactly right. And you know, this has unnerving parallels to what's happened with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, the spread of an extremist radical group, the feebleness of the national military in countering it, in the case of Nigeria and in the case of Iraq. And of course, this goes right to the criticism one hears more and more often on Capitol Hill about President Obama, about whether he's retrenched too much in U.S. foreign policy, whether there's been too little help, too little aid, both to the Nigerians and to the Iraqi government, whether we withdrew precipitously in 2011, for example. I think it's the crux of the issue. You know, across the Islamic world, you have the rise of these extremist groups. In the case of ISIS, one that our Joint Chiefs Chairman has deemed to be actually worse than Al Qaeda, more extreme than Al Qaeda, if that's imaginable. And so this has become a region-wide crisis.
You know, I've talked to senior intelligence officials on this very subject recently, and Mike's exactly right. And here's why it's so worrisome to them. We know, because of documents found at Osama bin Laden's compound when he was killed by Navy SEALs, that he was in conversation with the leaders of Boko Haram, giving them not only advice, but also asking other affiliates to give it support. It got support from Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb in terms of weapons. These groups are talking to each other. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Boko Haram in Nigeria, ISIS in Iraq and al-Nusra in Syria. These groups are all now talking to each other. The reason we recently had a heightened bomb alert was because a bomber from the master bomb makers of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who've launched two attacks on America already, one of their bomb makers went to Syria and was, you know, basically hobnobbling with the Syrian groups that are now taking over Iraq. So what Mike Flynn, who's the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, told me was if these groups start to build connective tissue and act in unison in some way, this is a much more dangerous situation than even pre-9/11 because they have a bigger footprint.
What should the U.S. be doing if that is the case?
We should take every one of these groups as mortal enemies of the United States, and the groups and the countries that are willing to confront them themselves, we should be giving weapons, training, surveillance, drones. We should be basically partnering with groups and countries who are being challenged by these groups, because believe me, they will turn themselves first locally, then regionally, and as we've seen with ISIS, it will then become a global agenda for them, because that's what ties them to Al-Qaeda's vision.
Nancy.
So I'm going to bring the bias of Egypt and Libya, because I've just spent the last 2 years there. And James is right. The challenge, though, in the region, in North Africa, for example, is in the post-Arab Spring world, you have, in the case of Libya, no state. And in the case of Egypt, a state that is so aggressively fighting back against those who oppose it, that it is locking up people by the thousands. And I've seen with my own eyes the creation of these new extremists on the ground by people who have been, in the case of Egypt, ostracized by their state, called terrorists by their state, and in the case of Libya, in the absence of a state, with all these little fiefdoms that are emerging. And so the challenge becomes the sort of stopgaps that the United States had come to depend on, dictators, frankly, are no longer there. And the absence of a state or a state that fears the return of opposition, whether it be liberal or Islamist, has created, I think, a fertile ground for those who are looking to recruit extremists.
And just how long ago was it we were talking about the Arab Spring?
I could just say that. I mean, this is hardly Barack Obama's fault, right? But the bottom line is you have almost total failure of the Arab Spring. Rather than secular moderates who are completely out of the picture now, you have dictators, as with Sisi in Egypt, or the restoration of Assad in parts of Syria, against radical groups that are the most powerful organized movements in the region. And that includes ISIS, includes these other groups that James mentioned. So that is not Barack Obama's fault. But what Republican critics do say about Obama is that he has been somewhat in denial about this, in his eagerness to be the president who is known as, you know, for ending two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and to deal with nation building at home, as he's called it so often, that his administration has been in denial about the links that James was just talking about in terms of the rise of these groups and the way they're talking to each other.
To say he's been in denial is one thing. To say that there are discussions ongoing, there are probably operatives in each of these countries trying to figure out the situation, I don't think he's ignoring anything. Do you?
I don't think he's ignoring it. As a matter of fact, and I totally agree with Nancy. I mean, the administration fought very hard against the military coup that basically made the Muslim Brotherhood, quote unquote, a terrorist organization. That's how you create an insurgency. You don't give them a path into politics. They had followed a path into politics, admittedly horrible at governing, which was probably not surprising. But, you could have waited to the next election to have them voted out rather than to have a military dictatorship come in there and start sort of basically calling them terrorists and creating the very thing that you don't want. So,
all right, to Terry in Florence, Kentucky, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to bring to the attention of the panel about the different groups that are being kicked out of Mosul as ISIS takes over there. And I wanted to ask, why is the media not really interested in talking about the different groups that get pushed out and what happens to them? In America, we pay a special attention to the Christian communities, but even beyond that, there are several different variations on Islam in there, and the stories that are coming out are very, very worrisome.
Well, I would not agree that the media is ignoring it. There's obviously a lot of smoke and debris coming from all these other stories we've been discussing. It's hard to focus on everything at once, which is a big problem for Obama. But just in the last day or so, the ISIS militants in Mosul blew up the Shrine of Yunus, the so-called supposed grave place of Jonah, the prophet Jonah, a place revered by all three major religions. Clearly, this is a brutal group. And the scariest thing about them is that they are not just destroying things. They also are governing in a very repressive fashion. I mean, they've killed in the last several days three Sunni clerics in Mosul who urge resistance to them, and they're a Sunni group. So this has been horrific. The media is paying attention to it, but again, it's hard to focus on everything at once.
I know Terry might seem like ignoring, but think about the issues that have come up, the countries, the crises that have come up this summer. By my list, Nigeria, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. In addition to the issues that we've been talking about today, Ukraine and Gaza and the Israeli conflict. And so it's been such a tumultuous summer, and so many places are erupting that what might seem like ignoring is really, I think, a world overwhelmed by the number of crises confronting it.
And one more. The president is meeting with Central American leaders today. What does he hope to get from that meeting?
Well, he hopes to get cooperation for them to receive these deportees. You know, we've got 70,000 plus unaccompanied minors now we're trying to figure out what to do with. A good portion of those are going to need to be sent back, and he wants to have them receive them and take care of them. And they're going to want more money to do that. So, and they're making the argument that is absolutely true, that the problem is really America's voracious appetite for legal drugs. We've created these cartels first in Colombia. They squeezed the balloon there. They moved to Mexico, squeezed the balloon there, and they went right down the chain of custody of those drugs into Central America, to the point where Honduras now is murder capital of the world, gangs running amok in a lightly governed space that they can't really control. So that's part and parcel of the problem, and we do share some responsibility.
So it's a very high-profile meeting. Three presidents from Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras meeting with the president. And there'll be this push-pull, as James talks about what can the United States do in terms of funding efforts to stop these problems in the way that the United States did it with Plan Colombia and in Mexico. And the president coming back and saying that the responsibility on you is to encourage your populations not to come to the United States to try to deal with the problems that are pushing people to leave your countries.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Lameen in Houston, Texas. You're on the air.
Diane, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to first point out that I'm calling from a neutral point of view, which means I am neither a Palestinian nor an Israeli. As a matter of fact, I'm an African native. But anyway, I realized that if we ever wanted to solve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, we need to start being honest about it. And what I mean by that is the predominant opinion here in the U.S., from the president all the way to the individual person on the street, is that Israel has the right to defend itself. And does it ever occur to the same society that Palestinians may probably have the same concept as well, that they have the right to defend themselves too? The other point is that I am disappointed about the naivety of the American government, because they think that these can be established under the given circumstance of Gaza, which is literally a prison, an open prison, like everybody describes it. Thank you very much.
Well, Lameen raises an interesting point, because one of the things the United States has said over and over again is that Israel has the right to defend itself. Those who have a different point of view would say, does it require this level of intensity of fighting? Does it require this kind of ground offensive? Does it require this many strikes for Israel to defend itself? And that's the question that I think Lameen is raising, is what is an acceptable level of response to that threat? And that's a debate that certainly is happening across the world, certainly across the Arab world, and even in parts of Europe, where you're starting to see some of this resistance to the Israel's claims that this is a necessary measure to defend itself.
Look, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict seems very, very complex. It always has. But at bottom, it's really quite simple. You have two peoples who want to occupy the same dot on the map, which is a physical impossibility. Israel is stronger than the Palestinians, and they have been exercising that strength. And that's, you know, that's really the whole ballgame. And it's not going to end because you don't have a politician on either side, frankly, with the vision and guts, perhaps since Yitzhak Rabin, you know, in 1995, to make the compromises necessary about that particular dot on the map. And
do you never believe we will get to a fair two-state solution?
A year ago, I would have believed it more than it seems like it's possible now. It does seem like the trend lines are going in the opposite direction, both in terms of the you know, the opinion in both the Palestinian and Israeli on both sides. There seems to be a sense of despair that a two-state solution can never be achieved.
I share Mike's pessimism, but I will say this. There's a reason why five U.S. presidents have gone hard at this problem, because if you don't solve this problem, then Israel does become a pariah apartheid state. It's clear in the demographics of the situation. We're very close to Israel. It's going to be very hard to maintain that relationship with a state that is increasingly internationally isolated, and that happens more and more each year. The Israelis know this too, so I think we're going to keep going at this until eventually, you know, Israel will come around.
Last quick word, Nancy.
Well, just I how can you not want to keep fighting for a solution given the violence that we've seen on both sides this week?
Nancy Youssef, James Kitfield, Michael Hirsch, thank you all so much. We didn't solve the world's problems, though.
Never did.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CarMax.